You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Offscript, an American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weiner-Kent, Editor-in-Chief. I'm here with
Russ Stammen, Managing Editor.
And Susie Evans, Senior Editor.
And we're here to talk about a few things. We're talking about one of the American Theater's great talents, Stephen Sondheim, and current productions of his work. We'll also be talking about a little bit about what seems to be a sea change, a lot of artistic director turnovers that are either happening or about to happen. And then we have an interview with two King Lairs for the price of one. Nathaniel Fuller and Stephen Yoakum, who are trading off in the lead role at the Guthrie. We talk a little bit about what that double casting is like and just about some of the challenges of the role and about some of the parallels which people can't help but make between King Lear and other leaders that we might know.
Swapping roles apparently is in vogue these
days.
Yes,
and indeed. I think I do mention that in our interview that you'll be seeing very soon our March issue.
April issue.
Our April issue, in which we will look at some very famous people who are trading off roles in a major Broadway production. And I'll just leave it at there. All right. So let's just jump right in. I suppose we'll start off with the Sondheim discussion. I thought it would be worth talking about because there are two major productions right now in New York, and a third one on the way, Pacific Overtures. At the Classic Stage Company. There's Sunday in the Park with George at the Hudson Theater, Broadway production, but it's built off of a City Center's Encores revival. It was last summer, I believe.
It was a gala concert at the City
It was a gala
Center
concert.
Encores.
Okay, it was special.
It's two nights only.
And this is more than two nights only. That is unfortunately a limited run. And then,
but the inaugural performance in the new Hudson Theater.
The newly refurbished.
Newly
Hudson
refurbished,
Theater, which,
yep.
Although I have to say, I had been in there before because TDF had their share of awards in there. Anyway. Beautiful theater. And then this Sweeney Todd at Barrow Street, which they've converted into sort of a pie shop inside and staged the thing there. We'll talk a little bit about that. But I what was striking to me when in thinking about these two shows and the third one on the way is that, you know, it's a good time to be a Sondheim fan in New York. Is there Sweeney and Sunday, two of his best shows? Pacific Overtures, I think, a very underrated show. I would consider one of my favorites of his. But it's never too bad a time to be a Sondheim fan. Our annual tally of play productions shows that he's the most produced musical theater writer, composer in the U.S.
Is that true every year?
It's been true for a couple years now. Now, what's interesting is that makes him even more popular than Rodgers and Hammerstein. Now,
that's what surprises
professional,
me.
Well, it's professional right. productions. It's possible if you looked at student productions and community theater, maybe Rodgers and Hammerstein would be higher. What's interesting is that Andrew Lloyd Webber currently has four shows on Broadway, but he is still not as produced in the smaller theaters. Now,
that's true.
I will say what's interesting, and I think these productions show this, the current productions, neither of these, I mean, I've struggled to find data on whether he has ever had a hit besides Forum, like an actual, they broke even, they made, then the producers made money kind of hit. Like Into the Woods revival maybe, or the original Into the Woods, anyway.
Original Into the Woods might have been.
Okay. So in any case, he's not someone who has ever had a long running hit like Webber or Rodgers. But he has revived so often. Often in small productions, limited runs. The one at the Hudson's limited run. The one at the Pie Shop, Barrow Street, will probably run for quite a while.
It just extended through December.
Yeah. Even though we can get into this. Even though one critic didn't seem to like it very much. One critic with a lot of influence.
I actually know a fair bit of people that's pretty split. I've heard on the Sweeney Todd at Barrow Street.
Right. Well, the show score grade is 90.
Well, yeah, most critics like it.
Even though Brantley's review was they put it at 60. Mm-hmm. So it's weird when the main critic is an outlier. Yeah, no, I actually was a little divided on myself. We can talk about that. I just wanted to tee up the subject by talking about how he's really is sort of an acquired taste. He's never been the big popular. He's never been. The question of his popularity is the question here. He's never had a popular hit in the sense of being embraced by all types, all ages. He's never had a Hamilton. He's never had a South Pacific. You know, Company might be the closest, or you could argue Into the Woods, right?
Well, Forum came close. That it had the longest run, and it was the first show for which he wrote both music and lyrics, and that was the only one to crack 900.
Yes, I know. Forum, I almost put in a separate category, though, because I think it's brilliant, but it's a strange beast. It's a strange... I mean, it would be great if he wrote a bunch more shows like that, actually, that were sort of romps, but he
Forum is probably the one that's done the most in like theaters across the country, though. It's done a lot.
I think possibly. We haven't done that breakdown of which show's done the most. I think Company's done a lot. Now, I think by acclamation, Sweeney Todd is his best, right? I mean, that's my...
that's your opinion.
No, I think most... A lot of people think it's his best.
People say it's the best piece of drama in the best overall canon.
Okay, maybe it's not his best score, although I think you could say it, you could argue it is. But it has the best book. That I think no dispute about that. Am I right? The best traditional book, right? One thing about Sondheim...
It's hardly a book. It's so small. I mean, is a book. It is a book. I know. I know the rules on books. We don't need to get into the Hamilton discussion. Oh, but it's a very, it's not a lot of books.
But
you
don't measure a book by the lines, as you know. You measure a book by the structure. And Hugh Wheeler, he wrote two of his best books. I think Light Music has a really great book. Yeah. I mean, in the traditional, storytelling way.
Right.
I mean, a lot of his, in fact, most of his other shows, if not all of them, have weird books that are not traditional, right?
Deliberately so.
Well, yeah.
A Little Night Music has a pretty traditional book.
Well, that's Hugh Wheeler.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's both Hugh Wheeler. And it's interesting that Hugh Wheeler is the one writer, librettist in his, I almost said memoirs, but his lyric books, that he doesn't talk about Hugh much. He talks about Lapine. He talks about Lorenz. He talks about...
that's interesting.
Weidman. Yeah, he just talks more about their contributions. I feel like Hugh was just sort of a fellow craftsman who came in there and did great work. Anyway, I'm talking too much. We all have seen Sunday, right?
Yeah. No, we're divided. I have seen Sweeney.
You and I have seen Sunday.
I've seen Sweeney.
We've all seen Sweeney. Wonderful.
Yeah, I'm seeing Sunday in April.
So we could talk about Sweeney first. Susie?
Well, I feel like this topic is Rob and I had lunch last week, and I told Rob that I'm not a Sondheim fan. So Rob's like, let's talk about Sondheim on the podcast and make Susie admit that she's not a Sondheim fan. But I will say I feel about Sweeney in a way, I don't know. He feels like, the musical feels like medicine to me. It's not my favorite Sondheim, but I do agree that it's a very well done musical. The music is good. The book is good. It's a good drama, but it's not a show I want to go see. If there's a production of Sweeney, I'm not like, oh, I have to go see Sweeney.
Right.
But I will say this production didn't change my opinion of whether I like Sweeney. I don't like horror. Those songs aren't my favorite to listen to, even though I know they're good songs. but I really enjoyed this production. It was like great singing, great acting, pretty minimalistic in terms of, there wasn't a lot of blood or a lot of like over dramatizing it. It was, intimate and well sung, well acted, good food before anyone had the pies.
Do you think the intimacy made it come across better? Like the fact that you're right up next to everything happening?
Yeah, I wasn't at one of the tables. I was at kind of, there's like six tables and there's like a balcony and then like a little small orchestra section. I was in the front row of the orchestra section, so I wasn't like right up in the actors' faces.
Okay.
But it did feel intimate. I don't know. I loved the novelty of the pie shop and I loved that they did the violence mostly metaphorically because that's usually the big turnoff for me.
Right.
I like the small band, I guess. It's very intimate with the piano right there and... it kind of like made the music a little more accessible, if that makes sense. It wasn't like, everyone loves the Sunday orchestrations and that music is amazing on stage, but it was nice to kind of get less is more in this case.
Yeah.
And a bit of background, this production of Sweeney Todd at Bower Street Theater is kind of a transfer from Tooting Arts Club in London, which was this group founded in this neighborhood in London that doesn't have a big art scene.
Oh, really?
and they found this actual pie and mash shop, Harrington's Pie and Mash, founded in 1908, that's considered the oldest pie shop in London, and they actually presented the show in a site-specific production there. Mm-hmm. And so this staging at Barrow Street is a reconstruction of Harrington's in the space in New York City. They say it's an exact replica, except there's no upstairs at actual Harrington's. Okay. There's no mezzanine, so that's got to be a bit of an adjustment. But
right.
Otherwise, they're doing what they can to mimic what they did in London.
It's about half the London cast came as well.
Yes, definitely the leads. I don't know if anybody else.
Yeah, the Sweeney and Mrs. Lovett are from London, but I think everyone else is American.
The judge and Toby. English, at least. I don't know if they were in the original cast. But.
Right.
But like Joanna and Anthony, those are...
And what did you think of this production, Russ?
Good this eats? Was the strongest Sweeney Todd I've seen.
Wow.
Yeah. A lot of the time, it really gets overblown in the horror. It's melodrama, so it's got to be over the top. But in this case, it was actually the first production I've seen that approached being legitimately scary. I wasn't frightened at any point, but like I sensed that, oh, this is what they're actually going for.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Really? I wasn't that scared.
I wasn't scared, but I understood conceptually that it was almost scary.
I was sitting in the front row of one of the tables, and literally this was one of the least scary razors of any Sweeney I've looked at, but the least real. And yet, the guy was wielding it right around near my face. It was like, okay, that was a little too much for me. I mean, in the best way.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I got my brother a straight razor for Christmas one year. He wanted it as a gift, and I was like, this makes me really nervous.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I was a fan of the John Doyle version, which I saw in London and here.
Also great.
Actually, I've never seen a bad Sweeney. This was a really strong one. Mm-hmm. I've seen ones where I was moved more emotionally. I felt like this was a rollicking good time.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, it also is, but it's also really passionate.
Yeah, but Sweeney never really feels like a rollicking good time. So, like, to feel like a rollicking good time was like what won this over for me.
Yeah, sure. Totally. I thought it was a bold choice, actually. You say it was it wasn't overblown in the sense of having big sets, but... The performances were not toned down. They were very, like, musical call, almost overly broad for my taste, but in a small space. But somehow that sort of made it work. It was like watching felt very of a period, like, again, music hall. It's great fun. We'd be interested to see what Norm Lewis and Carolee Carmello. I was trying to picture them in those parts.
Yeah, it's going
to
be interesting.
You know? Because the guy, is it Jeremy Seacombe?
Yep.
He like looks like a silent film.
He looks like terrifying.
Villain.
Yes. He does.
He like Google eyes. He looks like John Hyatt, actually, the singer songwriter. But like if John Hyatt were a silent film villain, with these bug eyes.
Yeah.
I mean, my friend and I were talking after the show, and we're like, Norm Lewis is going to have to put on that face. I think Jeremy wakes up with that face in the morning.
Yeah.
In a good way. I mean, he's great. He's just creepy.
But I saw. Orville Mendoza, who's I don't know what part he's playing in the new Pacific Overtures, but who I saw in Pacific Overtures and East West Players many years ago in L.A. I saw him Sweeney in East West Players All Asian production. That was also great. In fact, as I recall, it was a 9-inch production, but they built the whole chair, lever, and drop on like a little rolling thing in a small space. If I recall correctly, that's always tough. I think the geography of the second act got kind of wonky because it's the pie.
Right.
It only functions as a pie shop like twice in the show.
Yeah.
The rest of the time, it's just there's a counter and staircase.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest of it's just sort of like abstract geography, right? It's not. It's like the opening where she's, you know, whatever her song is about the worst pies in London. And
the worst pies in London.
The God, that's good. So anyway, you know,
and a little priest.
These are. Oh, that's true.
Yep.
These are quibbles. Those are kind of key numbers. So I'll take it.
I liked how. I mean, I don't want to totally spoil it. I like how they started. God, that's good from the lobby.
That worked out really well. And I will say, to segue to Sunday, one of my disappointments with the revival some years ago at the Roundabout was the small orchestra didn't seem to put it across. So I was worried about this score sounding great with just a piano, like winds and strings. It was great. it really works well with just three people. And the reorchestration that what's-her-name did, I forget her name, who did it for John and Doyle, that was also a great I love that orchestration.
Yeah. Was that Mary Mitchell Campbell?
I don't think so. It was a Brit. It might have been a... in any case, I'm beginning to think one of the reasons that Sweeney might be a great score is that it's indestructible. Like, you do play it on a piano, it still sounds amazing. It's like all
it's almost more accessible on a piano. And lows.
Yeah. It's like...
Like, really so hearing those, like, high piano notes really, like...
But, you know, you hear the high notes in an orchestra, like the Bernard Herrmann, like, strings, anyway. Speaking of the orchestra, I will say that was one of the things that I loved most about this Sunday in the Park with George. And I've been one of those people who has always felt the first act is one of Sondheim's best anything. But the second act of Sunday has always left me cold. What were you saying, Russ?
Oh, I was just going to add that... the answer to this Sweeney Todd question for the John Doyle production was Sarah Travis who did the orchestration.
Okay, I knew it was a woman. The orchestra's on stage for the Sunday in the Park with George, and the score, the dynamic range is what I would say most impressed me. It gets to the heights of the score and the sort of terms of emotional volume, but it also goes real quiet, which I think is so important. It's such a French influenced score, like Ravel, WC, and to have it be able to be quiet as well as big just makes all the difference for me.
Yeah, I think it's the original orchestrations.
Yeah. Too. Yeah. It's just beautiful. Chris Fenwick, I think, is the conductor's name. He should get a knighthood. I know this is not up for that. And the show's not even up for Tony, which is a crime. I think the other thing is that the leads are.
And Rob hates the Tonys, so that is like a huge statement to say.
Yeah,
the fact that Rob wants something to be up for
the
Tonys
don't matter. But in this case, they should get them. The leads are so strong in their performance. Their link between them, the chemistry somehow, the anti chemistry when they're not together. I couldn't say enough about how good the performances are in the leads, and how much that makes a difference.
Yes, Jake Gyllenhaal can sing, ladies and gentlemen.
He can sing. He can sing quite well.
God, that's good.
And Anna Lee Ashford blew me away. She's like the.
Have you seen her in things?
I've not seen her.
So this is Rob's first Anna Lee Ashford experience.
I confess, I never saw Kinky Boots or You Can't Take It With You or any of the other things she's done. Or Sylvia.
I mean, yeah, she's brilliant and she's amazing in this. I do think she has this like. Cutesy thing that she does that she kind of falls back on, but it works for Dot. I was kind of most impressed with her Marie and her Children in Art when she,
oh my God,
she was
Art
so good.
My wife said I think I sounded like Billie Holiday to her. It had the southern accent and the sort of smoky so good.
Yeah, I mean, I've never seen a production of Sunday before, so I didn't
looking over your Russ. That's right, you haven't seen this one yet.
Yeah,
and we're overselling it probably. I would just say that.
Well, I think it might be oversold already because it's probably sold out.
Yeah, this is the case where the show does live up to the hype, and it makes a case for a musical, which again, I was never that sold on the second act. Putting it together is still not one of my one of my least favorite Sondheim big numbers, and I think it still sticks in my craw a little bit in this production. And sort of a weird. It's weird to be making the point about commerce in the middle of the show, which is not about that at all, but. It's underplayed enough and it kind of like fits the character and it goes by nicely and it sets up the world that the sort of second George is in.
This is kind of like a small tie between the first and the second act, and I could be completely wrong in saying this, but someone told me that like when Mandy did it, he wore a fake beard in the first half of the show, and then he like...
That's what always happens.
And I thought it was nice that Jake has the same beard.
The continuity between the two.
There was like more continuity between both Georges.
I think that maybe that's the key, is that the second George is not really a character. He's not very fully realized. He's there just to sort of... put us in the contemporary time and then sort of make closure with Dot and make closure with the issues that were raised by the first act. And so if an actor, as Daniel Jenkins did and Mandy did, really tries hard to establish a different George, I don't know. It's like you set up expectations that the show can't fulfill.
Jake does feel like a different character in the second act, but there's a lot of continuity for the first act.
And I think someone else pointed out that a lot of people play putting it together, and the second George are just really nervous and like nervy, and like this Woody Allen character. It's like that doesn't. That's a valid interpretation, but again, it doesn't. You got nowhere to go, and he's much calmer. And
he was really calm, and especially that party scene.
I think that makes it work. I mean, you haven't seen the rest, but what struck me is that often the first act blows you away, and the second act's a letdown. And here the first act is like good. And somehow by underplaying the first act and making it all just, it has this consistency of tone, which I just thought was.
Yeah, I didn't feel like there was that much emphasis put on We Do Not Belong Together. It was beautiful, them together.
Right,
but it
right.
was like usually that's the huge, like, We Do Not Belong Together. And it wasn't like this, it didn't feel like a huge climactic moment. It felt like a sweet. Duet.
Yeah, there, yeah. Well, because I feel like there's more of that relationship to play out in the second act. It's like setting up mm-hmm. that there's more. I don't know. I just it worked, and the book seems smarter to me than it ever has. I've the roundabout production. Nothing against Roundabout or their wonderful work. That one just rubbed me the wrong way a couple years ago.
Who played George?
It was Daniel Jenkins.
Oh, okay. Evans.
Oh, Evans. Sorry,
Daniel Evans
is another
guy.
Character.
So
Daniel Evans, wonderful, and the dot was quite good. There were, and the song "Beautiful" in that production was the best rendition I've ever seen of that. That really just there were good moments, but this one really put it over the top.
And Daniel Evans took it a step further by taking off his hairpiece, right?
Exactly. He had a beard and hair. And in the second act, he was balding and clean-shaven. You know, he did good work. It didn't connect with mm-hmm. the material the same way. I just wanted to point out, there's a production Assassins opening at Yale Rep soon. That I think that was planned before the current political moment. But a lot of people have been talking about that show. And then Sweeney Todd just recently closed at the Olney Theater Center in Maryland. I'm sure there are many more productions coming up in April. What sold me on, so I was always kind of lukewarm on Sondheim, frankly, until I started to see a lot of productions of him in small theaters in LA, at Tiny Theaters, West Coast Ensemble, East West Players, the Colony Theater, and something about him in the small space, actually, where you can see the actors, you know, up close and hear every word. It really works beautifully.
Well, I mean, my first Sondheim in a small space was Barrow Street, so maybe I need to see more Sondheim in small spaces.
Yeah, it really
actually,
does.
That's why I saw Passion at Classic Stage Company.
Oh, yeah. And well, Passion is another story.
I don't know. Passion is for me.
I just to wrap that all up, I feel like his popularity is a case of, you know, like, I made the case in my interview I did with him a couple years ago. He's like, I think, best thought of his peers, not so much Kander and Ebb and Strauss and Adams and Jerry Herman, as Edward Albee
right.
and John Guare and other playwrights who have a following and whose work is done a lot, but it's done in small theaters, and it's done in short runs. It's not blockbuster material. It's just great plays that have great roles for actors and people, and has a cult following. I have a whole other theory about how Sondheim's ideally matched to sort of geek culture, because there's so many, talk about Easter eggs. It's like his scores really, and his shows bear repeat viewing. You find things that you never, you know, there's so much in there. They're so dense. But I think we've talked about Sondheim for a while. Anything you want to add to the discussion before we move on?
I should
mention your new qualifications to speak about it, Russ. You are an editor.
Well, before I was at AT, I worked at the Sondheim Review back when it was still publishing.
And now everything's Sondheim? You're not involved in that. I'm sorry.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah. But there's
what is everything Sondheim?
What is everything Sondheim, Russ?
Everything Sondheim, a TCG affiliate, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good to know.
Everything Sondheim is a new quarterly publication devoted to the works of Stephen Sondheim, and it's created by some of the editors of the Sondheim Review, and they have an online platform which the Sondheim Review didn't have as much of, and they just printed their first physical hard copy issue.
I can't wait to see it.
Yes.
Anyway.
Same here. I'm listed on their masthead, but really I'm more a consultant than anything else.
That's good to know. We'll look for that, and let's just touch briefly on this. It's really, I don't know what there's to say about it other than there seems to be a changing of the guard at a lot of our member theaters.
There's always kind of a changing of the guard at this time of the year.
Well, I don't know. It seems like there's a critical mass of There are four big ones that we're aware of. Michael Kahn, who's going to be on a podcast interview in a couple of weeks, from the Shakespeare Theater in D.C., is retiring. He's not just moving on to another job. He's retiring. A director. Directed a lot of stuff here in New York as well as in D.C. Tony Taccone is leaving Berkeley Rep after...
In 2019.
Almost 40... Yeah, 2019. I almost had 40 years there. And then Kent Thompson is leaving Denver Center Theater. And I think he's been there about a dozen years. I don't have the numbers in front of me.
Something like that.
And Randall Arney is leaving the Geffen Playhouse in Los Angeles. So... You know, that's a fair number of, and none of them have announced a successor, or their boards have not announced a successor.
Well, for most of them, they announced a long lead time so that they could pursue a successor. Well,
let's just say Tony Taccone is the one who's announced a long lead time. Michael Kahn, Michael Kahn is
end of next season.
And he's doing something smart, and I think maybe others are as well. He wants to hand off the theater and have the first season of the new artistic director be their season,
right?
Rather than sort of handing the keys to somebody like him, had let them finish off the season, which happened. Joe Hodge had a sort of half and half season when he took over the Guthrie. Mm-hmm. You can't always stage manage these things perfectly. And then, in the case of Randall Arney and Kent Thompson, there was some question about exactly how involved they were in the decision to leave. How much the board had to do with it.
They're not retiring, are they?
I don't know. I mean, no, I know Randall Arney's not. I don't think Kent Thompson is. Randall is going to direct. He's an actor and director of Steppenwolf original member. Not the original, but he was way back, goes way back with Steppenwolf. And he'll probably just keep directing. I imagine Kent Thompson, who we have a piece that's just will be out by the time this podcast is out about the Denver Center's Colorado New Play Summit, which he founded, and he hosted the last one a week or two ago, and we have a report about that. The big concern there, whatever happened exactly, the concern of a lot of board members that's voiced in the article is whether Denver will continue its commitment to new plays. It looks like they have Nataki Garrett there, they have Doug Langway, they've got a good team there, and they seem to be committed to new plays. But, you know, Kent did found the New Play Summit, so I guess the person will inherit that. And I mean, in the case of Randall Arney, what I know about that is Gil Cates, the producer, he used to produce the Oscars, actually, and Phoebe Cates' father. He sort of founded the Geffen Playhouse and made it his own and ran it as a sort of producing artistic director with Randall Arney as sort of an artistic director. And he died... You know, fairly suddenly. I mean, a couple years ago, and his son took over, Gil Cates Jr. And I think that leadership arrangement just hasn't worked as well, from what I understand. They want to take it in a different direction. It's not really for us to speculate, but that's what it seems to be the case. And Michael Kahn and Tony, they're ready. They've done their time, and they're going to pass the torch.
They're ready for vacation.
Yeah, exactly. Obviously, all these are white men, and the attention.
They're white men.
They're white. They're white men. The attention will be focused, I imagine, on whether the successors will not be white men.
We will see.
There's no litmus test for that, but of course, it would be great to see the kind of trend that we saw with Joe Hodge. At the Guthrie with Eric Ting at California Shakespeare Festival with Che Yu at Victory Gardens, Sarah Rasmussen at the Jungle, and so on. Vivian Banesh, who took Joe Hodge's job.
Right.
So, you know, some new blood we'll be seeing. And it'll be interesting also to see whether there'll be artistic directors, whether it'll be directors or producers in New York City. There's very few theaters that are run by directors anymore. They're all run by literary folks or producers, but around the country, there's a mix of those.
Yeah, and I don't think these theaters are going to be changing their management model just because these people are leaving. Like we've talked a lot about how Todd Ames is producing artistic director, which means he's both the managing director.
You never know. I mean, Joe Hodge is a director and an actor, But his title at the Guthrie is producing artistic director.
But he has a managing, I guess Todd does too. Jennifer Bielstein is the managing director. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you still have a managing director, but it's a question of whether you're the one over everything, or you're sort of in a joint artistic management relationship with managing director.
What is it for Joe?
I believe he's producing artistic director. And that might not be new for the Guthrie. And that's a case where he's still a director. It's just what you see around the country. I didn't realize I was speaking to someone about this. Carol Rothstein, who runs Second Stage, Oscar Eustace. These are folks who have directed. They are, in fact, I guess Carol Rothstein was a 21-year director, but you don't see them. Unlike Lynn Meadow at Manhattan Theater Club, who directs plays on her stage and, it's expected when you're a director who runs a theater, you're going to direct one of the plays each season. Oscar, I think he's directing a play this season.
He's directing Shakespeare in the Park.
Right, but it's been a long time since he's directed a play.
Well, Evan Cabinet, who took over LSD3 from Paige Evans, is a director, but I don't know if he's going to be directing on stages.
Yeah, I think this is a perennial push-pull and conflict where, artistic director is a full-time job, and then you want to also direct a play, and yet that's often the reason... You want to be an artistic director so you can run the theater and pick the plays to direct.
And direct the plays. I mean, we get a lot of season announcements sometimes where the artistic director is directing more than half the season.
So we will continue to cover that. There will be news in our magazine about these leadership turnovers. Now let's turn over to the lyric conversation I had with Nathaniel and Stephen Yoakum. Nathaniel Fuller and Stephen Yoakum. About King Lear. Here's that conversation.
Two quick notes about the interview. The first Lear to speak is Nathaniel Fuller. The second is Stephen Yoakum. I didn't have them identify themselves in the interview, so if you're confused... First is Nathaniel, then Stephen. One other point, I say at the beginning of the interview that Matrix Theater did a King Lear with Harry Gruner and Dakin Matthews. Actually, it was Antaeus Theater Company that did that. Although what I was thinking of was the fact that the Matrix Theater in Los Angeles used to do a lot of double casting, hence the confusion. Enjoy the interview.
I'm glad this is working out. It's really an honor to speak to you both. I wish I could see the production. I've read some great things about it, and my only experience with it, I think, the Matrix Theater in Los Angeles, you probably heard of that. A couple years ago, Harry Gruner and Dakin Matthews traded off, and they did a double casting thing. And then we have a story coming up soon about, Cynthia Nixon and, Laura Linney, who are switching off in the role of Regina. Actually, they're both switching off in two different roles. But have you ever done this kind of thing? You guys did repertory, but have you ever done this sort of like switching off in the same role before?
When we did Christmas Carol several years running, I was double cast with Richard Ohms.
And this is...
They would alternate performances. This was at the Guthrie. And although in this show, we're not playing Lear, we're playing a part called The Old Man, which is about a minute and a half scene. So we're both in here every night.
Oh, you don't get a break.
I substituted with Richard Ohms, we just came in. We didn't have to come in on the nights that we weren't playing.
Right.
Now, however, my daughter was in the show, so I had to bring her in anyway.
Okay. Now, so this was Joe Hodges' idea, because I understand he cast one of you, but he couldn't decide which one, right? Is that right?
Correct, yeah.
And
that's
so
what he said.
That's what he said. And is it also the kind of thing where it's also a relief? Because this is a monster role, right? It's a relief to trade off with someone.
The process of rehearsing and now that we're in the run is completely new to me. So it's a completely new process. But how we built it.
Yeah.
I think if we hadn't known each other for so long.
Right.
Because we've known it. We've worked together for over 30 years now. And I think if it was two completely different people who didn't know each other, that'd be... Yeah. Harder to do, because this really was a true collaboration from the beginning.
I would say between Steve and I and Joe, three ways around, we were all contributing, sharing ideas, accepting ideas from each other, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was great.
And I, for one, certainly appreciate my nights off because it's vocally very, very demanding. Yeah. And so it's nice to give the voice a few extra hours to recover.
Is this for both of you or for each of you separately the kind of role you thought one day I'll do my Lear? For both of you?
I hoped, yeah. I mean, it was definitely on my bucket list now that we are both of an age.
Same here.
Yeah, and it doesn't come around that often.
Of course.
So the fact that the opportunity came here at our home theater was it was a real kick for me and for Nat.
Yeah, it was it's one of those theater dreams come true.
A kick for.
So I want to ask about, you know, just sort of your insights into the role, what your approach to the role. I mean, obviously it's the same production, but it's got two different leads. And if you talk about at some point your paths part in the woods at some point, it's like, I'm going to go this way. Obviously certain things have to be locked down so that the production can run.
The way we built it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lent an organic quality to it because we would start on any given day, we would rotate who was going to start the day, taking the lead that day with the next chunk of work.
Okay.
We would get to, maybe 4, 5, 6, 7 pages, a couple of scenes in the play, and then we would take a break and the other would then step in. So we just kind of alternated all the way through the rehearsal process and built it as we went along, and then we would huddle up a lot during the day just to sort of say, well, what do you think about that? Did that,
right.
Or maybe I got another idea that I'd like to try out. And so there's a true sharing of new ideas, and we stole from each other a lot as well.
The basic values of the play, I think we agree on, the values of the character. We do some lines differently, and a couple of the rhythms are different, but I think we all arrive at the same points on the stage so that the actors that we're working with know basically where we're going to be. Some of the timing will be a little different. Some of the emphasis will be different. And the other actors have told us that they respond to us differently depending on who's playing the scene. But the basic blocking is the same in both shows.
The overall superstructure is the same.
It's very tricky on the thrust stage anyway because the cycles are so precise that you have to be in certain positions in order to be seen.
Oh, I didn't think about that. Yeah, so that it's in the thrust. So
we have to be consistent with the physical structure of the play.
Okay.
Otherwise, it'll fall apart from night to night.
Now, I can't get a sense from the photos if it's set in a particular time period, but of course, Rohan and of course other people have talked about in their response to it the way in which the play feels relevant. Of course, these classics always feel relevant. I think it's almost a canard to say, oh, it's suddenly newly relevant. But I think in this case, people are, it's on people's minds, an older leader losing control and acting impulsively. Was that a part of a conversation? Do you feel like, you know what, it's good?
It wasn't the primary focus of our conversations, and the setting does not call attention to modern factors. It's set in the 1930s, somewhere in Europe.
Okay.
And then the backdrop is a huge, almost like a band shell thunderdome kind of a setting. So it emphasizes bleakness and simplicity, hopefully focusing on the actors. But you can't do the play without having phrases and moments and things come up where you're going, wow, this is...
It's right in the language.
Right in there.
You know, tis the times plague when madmen lead the blind. It just, the audiences go,
My favorite line is, get thee glass eyes and like a scurvy politician seem to see the things thou dost not.
The audience goes,
Is there a particular moment for either of you, or maybe it's a different one, in the play, a scene that you're like, it's sort of the mountain you have to get over. Like, okay, well, once I get through that, I'm home free. Is it the storm scene? Is it the? Yeah.
We've pushed the storm. Our first act pushes all the way through to the end of the storm.
Oh wow! Okay.
So it's a long pull.
And beyond, actually.
Yeah, it's a long pull. It ends with our first act ends with with Lear falling asleep in the
mock trial
after the mock trial. So we've pushed all the way forward to, because we always thought it would be really hard to pick up after intermission in the middle of the storm.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. So sure.
We pushed all the way forward, and I think we both feel that our second act has just a completely different feel and tone to it because we've pushed through.
Yeah.
Through Blow Winds Crack Your Cheeks all the way through the first exhaustive point, and
so there's not so much yelling in the second
right.
act. There's a lot of sustained shouting in the first and anger in the first act.
Right, right.
And yeah. Then after the intermission, we get a long break while Gloucester gets his eyes poked out.
Yeah.
Several people have discussions about having affairs with other people before we have to come back on the heath. So.
Right, right. You have a little break there. I wonder if you could talk about some of the questions that come up in this play in terms of. Let me ask it this way. I don't think actors always tell me they can't judge a character. They can't have an opinion outside the character. They often, you know, start to think of their character almost the way a lawyer would a client. Like, I'm seeing his point of view, I'm going to argue his case. But in this case, you're looking at someone else's performance and building a performance together. Do you at some point go, well, I think he's wrong there. I think he's blind to this. He's not saying that. And he's not sympathetic in this moment. Do you make that kind of a judgment, or is it more?
Really, there's a duality there in terms of, like I say again, as we were building the role, there may have been certain rhythms. It's a very subtle thing with the both of us. I think there may be certain rhythms along the way that I'm hearing a phrase or something said a slightly different way, or a rhythm through an extended passage of text that I might have a slightly different motor going through it.
Right.
But really, there was nothing I ever absolutely just sat there on the sidelines as I was watching going, oh, hell no, that's wrong.
Well, yeah, I wasn't so much talking about judging the quality of performance, but more judging this character and where he's at morally with in the scheme of things. Because I've seen Lears that are more sympathetic and ones that are really just old bastards, you know?
Go ahead.
Well, yeah. I think that in some ways I want to leave the sympathy to the big question in this play for Lears is madness.
Yes, okay.
So when does he go mad?
Okay,
and how
yeah.
mad is he? And what I felt as an actor, along with what you said of being inside the character, is I don't ask that question so much.
Okay.
Because, you know, they're going, how mad is he at the beginning? Is he decrepit? We decided not to play him as doddering in the beginning of the play, that he is strong and forceful. There may be the beginnings of some sort of mental problem, but it's not defined. Shakespeare doesn't define it. Mm-hmm. So Lear says what he says, and Lear does what he does. Now, partway through the play, he questions whether he's losing his wits or not. And then later on, he has hallucinations. But if I'm going to play a hallucination, like seeing a mouse, I see the mouse and go after it. You know, I'm not trying to play mad stuff. I'm trying to think of the ideas that Lear sees as he sees them. Is that clear?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I think Joe also urged us to really stay in and on the text and stay with Lear. Has each and every time these issues come up, he has a problem in front of him that he needs to solve.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very, very much in the moment and in the tunnel of what's right in front of him,
yeah.
rather than trying to add a whole cognitive, you know, some kind of cognitive behavior on top of that, which might be interesting, but it's not clear. It doesn't tell the story very
yeah.
clearly.
Well, it's not like he's a Hamlet character where you have to decide is he really mad or putting up Lear. I mean, you can decide as an actor, but he's not self-conscious about this. He's not.
Yeah.
Until you say, as you say, he's wondering if he's going mad, but
yeah.
at that point, it's already taken. This play has taken him somewhere, and
it's also a wonderful opportunity for, you know, once we are both of us at a certain age where life experience just plays into it in every facet. We both have daughters.
Okay.
We've both gone through the phase of caring for aging parents.
Okay.
So much of that is just right in your wheelhouse in terms of what you live through when you get, if you're, and we're old enough and we're young enough still to be able to carry Cordelia on at the end.
One of the things that I'm not sure if I just ever articulated it to myself until this moment is that Lear is never disingenuous in the play. He's never trying to deceive anybody. He's always honestly reacting to his emotions, which are very rash. He explodes with temper at times.
Yeah.
But as opposed to other characters in the play, he's not trying to deceive anybody. And I think that, in some ways, will make him more sympathetic.
I'm curious. Let me ask you a question. When you talk to Cynthia and Laura about their process, how did that work for them? I mean, was it?
Well, I didn't do the interview, but I have read it, and I think that they did talk about it in terms of almost like a relay in which they're trading off energy.
That's a
little bit. And in that case, of course, I think one is playing Birdie and one's playing Regina. And Birdie's a less significant part, but they're both playing full parts. So it is different. What I will tell you is that when I would speak to actors who worked at The Matrix, and that's something they used to do all the time with Waiting for Godot and The Homecoming, they would do this double casting. Actors would talk about the push-pull of sharing a part this way and that some actors weren't really the right people to do it. And maybe these are people who didn't have repertory training or they just really wanted to do their Lear or their Hamlet or whatever. But it sounds like – did you both work at the Guthrie when it was still doing actual repertory and had a company?
So we also worked with Joe when Joe was an actor.
Right. Okay. Well –
so we were ahead of the game sort of in that respect, too, because he was in repertory with us when he was a young actor.
So there's a collaborative spirit to that. I mean, by reputation, I've actually never been to the Guthrie myself, but by reputation, that's what the Guthrie has humble in repertory. So I imagine there have been some famous Lears on the Guthrie stage that you've either both of you have watched or been a part of, not as the lead. And I wonder – if not just the Guthrie, but are there other Lears that you've looked at and thought, now that's an interesting one. I want to take some ideas from or inspired you or daunted you.
Sure. I mean, I looked at performances. Ian McKellen came here a few years back with his Lear, but I've looked at videos and I've read about Lear performances and there were ideas that we borrowed. And then, the other thing was, though, I would look at some of those Lears and I'd go, I have an opportunity to not make that choice.
Yeah.
I don't care for that so much. And so looking at various possibilities, in a way, I found I was able to weed out some things to try to focus on the story.
Right.
I think for me, they just added into the fabric of what I was able to choose from. One of my earliest experiences was when I was in college. At McAllister College here, I saw Len Carreyrou play Lear back at the old Guthrie in 1975. And then one of the most interesting ones was the late Ruth Malachek when they did it at Mabu Mines in the all-female version at BAM, probably 15, 20 years ago. Hmm. And then we both saw McKellen when they came through with the RSC. But I don't think I... There weren't specific things that I remembered and choose to stick into what I was doing. It's mostly the overall memory and just sort of fabric of what they were doing so that I thought, God, I'd love to be able to do that someday.
Right.
But I found that as I started reading about how unproducible the play had been and how huge the part is and how it's the culmination of an actor's career,
right,
I realized pretty soon that I had to put all that away.
Yeah.
We're basically doing an acting job. We've got a story to tell, a set to work with, other actors to work with, and we need to focus on that.
Yeah.
And bring that forth and not worry about literature and not worry about what the critics are going to say, because every Lear that I read about was criticized by somebody. So you know, we just had to do our acting work. And when you get to that, it's all work that every moment in the show is probably something that we've done before as an actor, every emotion we've expressed. And so that's what we had to focus on.
Sure. I don't want to give you critic's jobs here, but I did look at Rohan's review, and I think his basic takeaway was that Stephen, you're the earthy Lear, and Nat, you're the ethereal Lear. And he said you both were great, and you're both heartbreaking, and you both arrived at the same place. I don't know if you would care to talk to each other about what you think your performances are like, or no, you don't want to go there.
I have no idea what he's talking about. I did have a friend of mine who read that review and said they didn't. He's a tennis playing buddy, and he said they didn't say anything about your ethereal backhand.
Yeah, I have no. I mean, you read those things and you go, oh well, okay.
Yeah, okay, yeah, sure, yeah. Sure. No, that's the job for the critics to find the adjectives.
I will tell you that until I read that, ethereal was not a word I ever thought about in connection with this. And I don't know if you ever thought about earth.
Yeah, I don't.
So, I mean, obviously there's a difference in the qualities you bring to the work. And you've talked about that. You were in the room with each other. You know how you're different and how you're the same. Let me ask you this, a totally different question. Another question that's asked about the play. When you were talking about Lear's impulsiveness, do you think he was a good king?
I think we started with a premise that, yes, he was a very good king.
He was a very good king. He's just losing that at the end. He didn't raise very good kids, except for one, right?
Yeah, I mean, he may not have been the greatest parent, but he was.
Right.
Our take on the beginning of the play is that this is a great party that everybody's been invited to see, and everybody knows something is going to happen, and then things go haywire. But we start with the premise that he's been a pretty damn good steward of his kingdom.
Right.
And we also ask the question that as he's getting older and he has three daughters and no sons, what's he going to do with the kingdom? I heard a lot of comments about Lear that, you know, dividing up the kingdom was the most insane thing you could possibly do.
Right.
We started to ask questions about, well, what would you do?
Yeah, yeah.
And this is a decision, didn't work out well, but we don't want to say that that's the beginning of incipient insanity.
Sure.
And it's a hard problem. I mean, even in Iraq not long ago, people were saying a great solution might be to break Iraq up.
Partition it, right, so, right. Well, so now, then I'm just going to go right into the text with you then. So if he was a good king and you basically think splitting up the kingdom, not such a bad idea, there's a reason for it. What is this problem he has where he does not hear his most loyal daughter? What have you decided about that? Is it hubris, ego, or is it really sincerely? Yeah, go on.
I think it's a combination of hubris and ego, and also
temper.
Temper. Okay.
And a switch gets flipped.
Yeah.
It's a combination of a lot of those things. I mean, this feels very different to me than for instance, the way Leontes goes off the rails in The Winter's Tale. I think that in The Winter's Tale, and I played Leontes at one point, that was always a question you had to ask yourself.
Yeah.
Like, what the hell does that come from?
Right, right.
But I think with Lear, you don't ask that. I don't, when I'm watching it or hearing it, I don't ask that same question. It seems to lead there, perhaps not logically, but you're not so taken aback by the surprise of the thing.
I do feel that Lear is the type of person who makes a decision, and up till now he's had a great deal of success with it. Once he makes a decision, he doesn't apologize, and he can't go back.
Yeah.
He says it as much. I have sworn, which I break our vow, which I durst never yet.
Yeah.
Can't change direction. So once he goes down that road, he just has to keep going.
Yeah.
And that speaks to what you were talking about with, I mean, we don't have to look very far for the political context there either.
No. No, I don't think Shakespeare used...
Where there's a person who's incapable of being wrong.
Yeah, Shakespeare didn't use the word, the phrase double down, but that's what we're talking about here.
Someone exactly. Just
doubles down on when they're wrong. Well, speaking of double down, we have double Lear here. If there's anything else we want to touch on before we go, I think we've touched on a few things here.
One thing that we always, when we're doing classical text and stuff, especially with modern audiences, whenever we do talk about it publicly, especially in a tragedy, because it's called The Tragedy of King Lear, that we forget that there is so much humor in these plays.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That comes out of human behavior, comes out of human foibles. It comes out of the way people are in a room with each other. And so it was a really glorious to find how much laughter there was from the audience in terms of how ridiculous everybody's being.
So, yeah, give me a good example.
The poignancy of life is when you're juxtaposing that suffering with absurdly funny things. The scene on the heath,
yeah,
where Lear is totally mad,
yeah,
is a very funny scene in many cases.
Yeah, yeah.
Thou shalt not die for adultery. The wren goes to it. The small gilded fly.
Let population thrive.
Yeah, yeah. That's a good laugh line.
And the line about the scurvy politician comes from that, and yeah, several other very funny lines.
And the scenes between Kent and Cornwall. I mean, when Kent is dressing down Oswald with all that glorious language, it's great stuff. And nobody cusses. Yeah. Nobody cusses better than Shakespeare without being profane.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Wonderful. Yeah, it sounds like a production that I wish we could all see. Somehow the Guthrie's got to get on that National Theater thing and start broadcasting these things so we can take a look. Do our audiences? I know Rohan and some others. I'm glad he saw both of you. But are some audiences coming back for just to catch both?
I think so.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a guy at the talkback the other day, one of the talkbacks, that said, "Is this just a ploy to sell more tickets?" And I said, "Well, what do you think?" He said, "Well, I think I want to come back and see the other guy too, because this was pretty good."
So yes, it is a ploy, a successful ploy. Well, wonderful. Well, great to talk to you guys.
All right, great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
All right, take care. Bye now.
Take care.
And we're back with some recommendations of things to see, think about, read, or otherwise, you know, just things to talk about. Russ?
Sure. I will recommend Linda at Manhattan Theater Club, which is a show about a woman who's surrounded by the patriarchy and grapples with trying to promote a different marketing tactic for cosmetics that will target women over 50 rather than showing ads with just young, beautiful women. And the show details the challenges that she faces and how her life kind of tears apart at the seams. And it's a good piece of drama.
Penelope Skinner.
Yes, indeed.
British.
Yes. Brit. Yeah, I recommended that in addition to Sweeney Todd because I didn't want to do
right,
a total cop
right,
out.
Right.
Yep.
Cool. Sounds good. Susie?
I will recommend, it's not a perfect production, but as listeners of this podcast know, I'm a huge Tracy Letts fan, and Man from Nebraska at Second Stage, I really enjoyed getting to see it. I've never seen that play on stage. I love Reed Birney and Annette O'Toole, and it's a great cast. David Cromer directed it, I believe. Yeah. I like his work. It's not a perfect play. It's not a perfect production, but Reed Birney is so likable and plays put upon old white guy so well. And you know, it's Tracy Letts play, which I'll always sign up to see. I'm looking forward to his new show, which is coming to Steppenwolf this month, I think it starts previews, or maybe next month. And I think Man from Nebraska runs for at least another week or two, so it's worth checking out.
Well, you stole the thing I was going to talk about, but that's okay.
Yes.
So
did you see Man from Nebraska too?
I did, and I was going to. I was going to be very equivocal in my recommendation, because
You can recommend it too.
It's a play I thought that was extremely well directed and well performed for a play, which feels to me like a very young play. What's interesting about that play is that I was a huge fan of Bug, like a Bug at Barrow Street, actually, with Michael Shannon and Shannon Cochran. And Reed was not in the night I saw it, but he was in that production. Blew me away. And I'm not somebody, despite my love for Sweeney Todd, who likes gore on stage, who likes violence. I don't run to that when it's done well, I'll acknowledge it. Bug is one of my favorite productions ever of anything. Loved it.
All right.
Disturbed me. Anyway, I remember, and I was aware of Killer Joe. I hadn't seen it at the time. Killer Joe, his first play, which is like really even more violent. And
yeah, I went to see that man, except for the violence.
Man from Nebraska was published by our magazine about 15 years ago, or after Bug. And I was like, oh, a new Tracy Letts play. This is great. And I read it, and I thought, It seems so clearly to be an attempt to show I can write plays where people don't kill each other. I can write plays about faith and about middle America. I can write a serious play. And it feels to me a little bit still like a play where he's trying to prove that he can write another kind of play. And he isn't quite all there.
Like, yeah, but it has like, you can see the seeds of something like August or something like Mary Page Marlowe.
The thing that made it enjoyable was his voice was so clearly in that play.
Like, yeah. I actually saw a lot of Mary Page Marlowe in it as I was watching it. Like,
yeah, so I haven't seen that, so I don't know.
Have you read it?
No, I haven't read it.
Oh, yeah. Mary Page Marlowe is a better play.
Yeah.
But there's similar themes.
Yeah, I felt like, I think my wife and I both agreed, sort of felt like there were a lot of blanks he just didn't fill in this story. And a lot of things where it felt like his idea of London Bohemians was kind of amusing. I don't know. I was not bored, which is my new bar for plays. I mean, if the play held my interest throughout and I didn't like all of it. I don't know if I'd recommend it to everybody, but it really is. It's a strong piece of work. And Reed Burney, you know, I just think that guy.
You could read the phone book.
Is amazing.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly.
But I thought, I mean, there were a lot of holes in it, but I thought like David Cromer handled the like transitions between scenes so well. And like the holes kind of work because there's so many questions of faith and family. And so it gives you room as an audience to interpret it.
Yeah. I thought it was a well done play, and it was a good night at the theater. Mm-hmm. It's a play which I think would probably be picked up now, because I think it's only being done now years and years after it was made, because it's Tracy Letts, and now he's big Tracy Letts, right?
Yeah, but he's got all these new plays now, so why do we got to do old plays?
The sitcom of Superior Donuts. Have you seen that?
I love Superior Donuts.
The sitcom?
Oh, I didn't watch the sitcom.
Oh my God, it looks terrible. The ads.
Has it aired?
I saw ads for it.
Did it get picked up?
Yeah.
Yes, Judd Hirsch is the...
I thought Brian D'Arcy James was doing it.
Oh, it's... Anyway.
Judd Hirsch is the McKeon part?
I think so, yeah.
Interesting.
Anyway, it does not look great.
Tracy didn't write the sitcom. It's
I don't
adapted.
Think so.
Tracy's
getting some money for it.
Yeah.
In any case, I feel like it's a play which is worth looking at again. If it pops up at other resident theaters, it would be a good thing. I'd love to see other productions of it.
I mean, it's a good set cast, good different types of actors.
Cast, a lot of meaty parts in it, a lot of interesting stuff.
I liked it.
So I think on that sort of mixed recommendation, there's that. I think we had a good show. And rate us on iTunes, say nice things about us. It helps other people find the show. Links to what we talked about. And maybe even other things will be on the show page. So, till next time.
See you at the theater.